All right. So we have the Beargler.
Yes.
We have the
Snackoderms.
The Snackoderms. What did we end up calling the otter? Was that the that wasn't
oh, man,
the
we had a good one.
Maniac, was it? I don't know. We had some good name for the otter.
Donald, find out what our good names for our animal band, because we had a good one on the Kleptomaniac, too.
Yeah, and I think that was otters, or that was animals.
Yeah, it was definitely animals.
Okay, so you excited about this one?
Yes.
In New Zealand, there were two penguins that sneaked into a train station sushi shop and stole their sushi.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's adorable.
That is adorable.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the crossover between penguin food and human food is sushi.
Exactly.
So, well done, penguins.
Yeah. It says, the penguins were temporarily detained by Wellington police before being released back into Wellington Harbor.
They detained them, didn't
However, the owners of the shop tonight told RNZ the birds had again crossed busy traffic lanes between the harbor and the station to the sushi bar. So, yeah, they know where this is. They're repeat offenders. That's awesome. If you are in Wellington, go to Sushi B in a train station, and maybe you'll see some penguins there. Yeah.
Do you got anything?
No, I have nothing. Do you? You have that smile that says
you have
a good one.
I have that smile, but I don't actually have anything.
You don't?
Everything that I've come up with is just even more dumb than the ones I normally come up with. Like, you know, the penguins. But then, you know,
So it's blue penguins. I don't know if that helps. And there's two of them.
Yeah, let's give me some time on this one. Yeah. I might need time on this one. Penguin doesn't really...
What if we go Italian mob and we call them the Penguidos? These are Italian penguins in the New Zealand harbor.
All those Mediterranean penguins.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many of those.
They somehow got to New Zealand.
Penguinos. That's good,
the
Dan.
Penguidos. They're stealing the sushi.
Okay.
You know, because that's also classic Italian food.
Of course. I mean, you know, they branch out. They do whatever they need to do.
They have refined international palates, the Penguidos. We're going to see them hitting different food stands all over the world now.
Penguidos. That's like the Gator Gourmands there. You know, we've got an international, well, I guess the Gator Gourmands. We're American, just with some French.
Some French history. Yes. Also, it's sad that they weren't actual gators, right?
Yeah, I know.
The gators were the food in that one instead of adorable animal thieves.
I can't imagine gators being adorable as they steal, as they eat. Have you seen like the video of the person who throws meat to a gator and it reaches for it, it just grabs the other gator's leg and then just goes into that spin and rips off the like gator next to its leg and eats it? And the first gator that lost its leg is just like...
It's like, dude.
Dude. Like, really, it doesn't flip out. It doesn't just like, did my arm just get eaten? And yeah.
I am very sad that we don't have Adam in the room with us
to
put up a picture of AI-produced penguidos.
Adorable gators eating.
We found adorable gators.
The hungry little gator. So, all right, you're proving me wrong. Those are kind of cute.
Yeah.
Those are.
Alligators can be very cute. The alligators in Dora the Explorer are adorable. Sorry, this is what you get from me today.
So, a month or so ago, maybe a little longer, we talked about doing an episode about publicity.
Yeah,
and book this is
publicity specifically.
Not the next episode we're recording, even though we're wearing the same clothing.
Yeah, we actually arranged. We had pictures taken of ourselves so we could dress the same way.
Yes.
When we came back to it.
That's the sort of commitment to continuity that you deserve.
I'm pretty sure... We actually had somebody arrange these piles so that they match what was visible at the end of the previous episode.
My ice water cup, I don't know if that's visible on the screen, but you know, exact same level of ice.
It was hard to arrange it into the same iceberg shape that it was in before, but we have done it.
I mean, there's
we care about you.
People on set, that's their job.
Mm-hmm.
And we, of course, have those people hired.
Yes, our continuity team.
Yes.
We never refer to them by name, but they're all right off camera doing valuable work.
So, book publicity.
Book publicity.
Book publicity is a bit of a strange duck, and I thought we would talk about it.
I think that is a great idea. The joke that I made at the end of the previous episode was that whatever we say, by the time it actually airs, it won't be true anymore. And that is true of some publicity, but certainly not all book publicity.
No, but I mean, publicity in the contemporary era changes based on what the algorithms and the apps currently are, in ways that is pretty obtuse for you know, regular folk to figure out. I don't know if I count as regular folk, but right, like, have I told my my great first book signing story on the podcast?
Probably.
Have I?
But give us the Cliff's Notes.
The Cliff's Notes?
Give us the AI-generated study guide.
So when I first realized that book publicity was a bit of a mess was when I published my first book and asked for a book signing. And I like called the publicist assigned to me, and they're like, oh, you want to do a book tour? And I'm like, well, yes, isn't this what authors do? They're like, oh, yeah, I'll get back to you. I'll get you a signing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay. And so she calls back a week later. She's like, good news. I got you two signings for a book tour. I'm like, great. She said, the first one's in Fresno this Friday, like in a week or something like that. That's close to Utah, right? I got ones close to Utah. It's a 13-hour drive.
Yeah, Fresno is a ways away.
Yeah, like, she's like, that's close to Utah, isn't it? And I'm like, okay, I suppose. And is the next one the next day? She's like, no, no, no. The next one's in San Francisco. It's a week later. But that's the West Coast, so it's close to you, right?
Ugh.
And so my first book tour, quote unquote, was I drove 13 hours to Fresno and had a signing. And then immediately got in the car and drove back because they did not give me a budget for a hotel room.
Yeah.
And I was pretty poor. And then the next week, I drove to San Francisco. There I did stay.
Again. Okay.
Because I splurged and bought a Motel 6 and then drove back. But yeah, I drove 13 hours, signed for an hour, and drove 13 hours home. And then did that again because book publicity. And then that publicist was my publicist for 2 months until they left to go get another job. And then I had another publicist that I never met who left several months later to go get another job. And then I was assigned another publicist who I actually really liked, who stayed with me for about 8 months and then left to get another job, but then is still one of the heads of publicity at Penguin Random House. So I get to interact with him now and then.
That's good.
And then I went through like three more. And then I got Dot Lynn, who was just brilliant and amazing, who eventually left to get another job outside the book industry because they didn't pay highly enough. And this is just repeated. Right now, I have some pretty good publicists, but I mean, I'm at the top of the heap. And so whoever's the best, they assign to me now.
Yeah.
But when you're a brand new author, I don't know if you have this experience, but you feel really disposable. Like nobody wants you.
Yeah.
Nobody cares.
That's how I felt with Harper. With partials to a certain degree. The editor that I worked with was two editors in the beginning, fantastic and wonderful. The publicist that I had in the beginning was wonderful. But like you say, she left, everything shook up. Harper is a very big engine that kind of does its own thing regardless of who's underfoot. My first publicist at Tor is actually Alexis.
Oh, Alexis is now my publicist, and she's amazing.
She's incredible. You know, she's been in that position at least 15 years.
You lucked out.
Which never happens.
Yeah.
She's wonderful, and I was very lucky to get her.
Yeah. No, Alexis has been great. Like, when I finally got Alexis, it kind of stabilized, and I've had Alexis for quite a while. But, you know, this is, I think, a habitual problem of the publishing industry. Is that not paying well enough for people to live and work on Manhattan.
Yeah.
Like if book publishing were in, I don't know, if it were in Greensboro or something like that, right? If it's like, you pick a city, a good city, but the rent is not the Flatiron Building in Manhattan, then maybe you could pay people what they pay people to work in publishing, but they don't. And so the only people that stay in publishing are the editors who just love it so much that they're willing to spend their entire lives eating croutons as a full meal for dinner now and then.
Yeah.
And then the publishers who get actual executive salaries and can afford to like live and things in, it's a mess. And so they expect these publicists to get that kind of salary. And so of course they can't stay.
One of the fitness health companies that I used to work at,
yeah,
they kind of did the same thing. And the way that they explained it, and this always felt really cheap and dirty to me, was, you know, we don't want the, you know, experienced ones who've been around for a while. We want the new ones who are really hungry and they're going to do stuff and then they're going to move on to another job. We recognize that we are essentially training you for a better job later.
Yeah, that's corporate speak for we don't value this job.
Oh, yeah. It was the worst job I've ever had.
Yeah.
It was terrible. And if you're listening to this, it was not you, because the person I worked for would never listen to this show.
And I'm sure that they pay some publicists well after you move up in the ranks. Otherwise, good publicists couldn't stay.
Yeah.
And things like that. I just think that the industry as a whole in publishing doesn't regard publicity as highly as it should. They don't fund it. And there are some habitual problems that they have to overcome. One is, as you said, publicity changes so fast, it can sometimes feel like, why are we even paying someone to do this? Because they're...
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Yeah, to some degree, especially right now, grabbing some recent college graduate who's 22, 23 years old and understands whatever the kids these days are doing, grab them, employ them for a year, and then whatever the kids these days are doing will change and you hire a new college graduate, which sounds horrible, but that's kind of how a lot of it works. Things that worked, you know, for my first series, didn't work anymore for my second series, didn't work anymore for the third one. And it's just a constant treadmill of, well, which app, Instagram or TikTok or
if
whatever.
The indie authors can keep track of it, which they can, and continue to do it, then a publicist can, if you treat them well.
Yeah.
And they have the right training.
Which I suspect is why Alexis has been so successful and so long-lived in the position. Because she does pay attention to what indie authors are doing. She does know what's going on.
And let's give publishing, let me throw them this bone. Publicity for books is odd for entertainment in general. Manhattan is full of a lot of corporations, you know, talking about how you do publicity. And how you do publicity for toothpaste is so much different than how you do it for books. First off, everybody buys toothpaste. So your job is to get them to buy your toothpaste instead of the other toothpaste.
Yeah.
Where books, not everybody reads a book. And indeed, when you do publicity, if you're a toothpaste company, you may have 8 different varieties of toothpaste, right? Tor publishes 300 books a year or more. And each of those books by different authors for a slightly different audience. And so publicity becomes a very difficult prospect when instead of having 8 different options that all basically do the same thing, you have 300 different options who are all for different demographics. That is why publicity has been so hard for books traditionally, and why then the publicity departments are generally underfunded, because the one consistent way that books sell is by word of mouth. And so there's some incentives, I don't like them, but there's some incentives in publishing to just publish everything, see what gets the word of mouth, and then put some money there.
That was 100% what Harper was doing when I was with them. And to be fair, this was a long time ago.
Yep.
None of the same publicists are there as far as I'm aware. But it really was throw everything at the wall and hope we get another Veronica Roth. And sometimes they would, and sometimes they wouldn't.
Yeah, this is why I eventually built my own publicity department, because I got tired of losing publicists and having publicists too overworked to work on their best-selling author, right? Like,
yeah. And see, at the same time, I'm like, I'm glad that the debuts are still getting attention and that not all the money goes to a Sanderson or a King or a Rowling or whoever.
Right, because we don't need it as much.
Yeah.
But, you know, one adage of publicity is force multiplication. Mm-hmm. If you can increase my sales 10%, or you can increase a new author's sales 10%, or even if you increase theirs by 100% and mine by 10% by the same dollar spend, by simple economics, you spend it on the Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah.
That ignores the fact that that new author is going to be your Brandon Sanderson in 30 years when Brandon Sanderson can't be your Brandon Sanderson mm-hmm. anymore. But when they are long-sighted instead of short-sighted, they understand that, and the publicists generally do, but the industry wavers back and forth between grasping that concept that we need to be building the next mm-hmm. generation's Brandon Sandersons and the concept of, why don't we cut all these people who don't make us money right now and only publish Brandon Sandersons?
Yeah. I have a friend who got a contract, went to, you know, had a chance to go to New York and visit the publisher, met the publicity team, mm-hmm. and the publicity team introduced themselves as the Sarah J. Maas Fan Club. And, you know, like you say, mm-hmm. it is a financially wise decision to in the short term to act like that. But it is very short-sighted, and it's also very just depressing to the new authors. Like, how am I ever going to get attention? How am I going to stand out if the publicity only cares about their cash cows instead of about the rest of their catalog?
A tale as old as publishing is, and we heard this the first time from Dave, mm-hmm. and it's borne out multiple times as I've watched it. Publishing house gets new management or acquires another small imprint.
Yeah.
You know, and new management comes in from another industry to take over it. And their industry, the answer to how do we improve our margins is to look at the products that aren't selling as well and refocus on the ones that are selling really well. Mm-hmm. If you took over your toothpaste brand and you looked at it and found, you know, of the eight, two were severely underperforming, you would be like, well, let's cut those two and refocus our attentions for a while if we're having troubles on the six that we know work.
Mm-hmm.
But you will see this in publishing time and time again, where people come in and say, all right, cut everyone who doesn't sell above this threshold, which is just stupid in this industry, because if you aren't cultivating the next generation, like, yes, you can sell the same toothpaste forever. I bet despite the boxes all saying new, the toothpaste hasn't really changed. Mm-hmm. You can't sell Brandon Sanderson forever. I will eventually fall out of style. I hope that it happens years after I've passed away, but...
But it is inevitable.
It is inevitable. Very, very few books become perennial. And if they do, even then, the new bestsellers and their emerging bestsellers do better than them. And like, you can just look at our book scan numbers and compare me to Tolkien, where we're doing as well or better than Tolkien most years. Even though Tolkien, any publisher would be smart to keep a Tolkien instead of a Sanderson, because Tolkien's still going to be doing that in 100 years, right?
Yeah.
I hope that I will, but there's no guarantee. But regardless, you know, 99% of what's selling today won't be selling in 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
or even 15.
Yeah. And so if you cut all that out, but they do it time and time again. They come in, they're like, clean house. They're like, all right, well, Brandon Sanderson makes all the money. Fire everyone that's not Brandon Sanderson. How hard could this be? All the time. It happened to Dave himself.
Yeah. So my wife, and I think I've said this before, she went back to school. Uh-huh. She's in the vocal performance and opera program at the University of Utah.
Right.
And so they had a couple of weeks ago a concert that was like a greatest hits sampler mm-hmm. platter of just famous opera songs and arias and ensembles and things.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because other than, you know, the obvious like big Mozart chunk in the middle mm-hmm. and a couple of Rossinis and things, most of it was stuff that the average person had never heard of. And the guy would get up every three songs and he'd say, okay, these next three songs, let me tell you about them. Here's mm-hmm. the Mozart. He's like music industry's Tolkien, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He's been popular forever and will be popular forever.
Yep.
And then he'd say, and here's this other one that came out the same year as Marriage of Figaro and was way more popular and everyone loved it. It was the greatest hit, the Oscar winner of the year. No one in the audience has ever heard of it, but we're going to do this aria from it anyway. And it was about half and half, I feel like.
Mm.
Either, you know, grand old standards that everyone's kind of heard, or just obscure stuff that used to be the hotness and then faded away.
I mean, this is really common in books. I don't know if people know how common it is,
mm-hmm.
but I remember the first time it really hit me when I was doing some research on Dracula back in college. And Dracula, like, they had a kind of bestseller list, not like we have now, but it's a new enough book that they were tracking bestseller lists. And when it came out, like the year it came out, it was only like number, like, you know, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And there's a couple other, like one other book on there that you'd recognize. And I'm like, who are these, you know, 4 books that outsold Stoker, like Dracula,
mm-hmm.
that I've never heard of? And I went and looked them up, and they were just enormous bestsellers.
Yeah.
They, you know, and not just one-offs. It's like authors who had been consistently selling for a decade and were just, you know, the Tom Clancy's of their era and things like that, or the J.K. Rowling's. And then mm-hmm. there's this book, Dracula, that now people are still buying 120 years or whatever it is later. And you can't guess what those will be, which is really interesting in entertainment.
I had an American literature professor who would do that. And mm-hmm. so we'd read like The Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
And then say, okay, these are the other things that were more popular the same year than Hawthorne was. And yeah, in many cases they were. They were like the Pat Rothfuss of mm-hmm. early New England,
yeah.
who had a huge career and was very popular. But there's the one or two that jump out and become, for whatever reason, the classic that sticks around forever.
Mm-hmm.
Harlan Ellison, in his, you know, one of the introductions he wrote to Repent, Harlequin, he
yep.
said, you never know which one they're going to write on your tombstone.
Yep.
Which, you know, in speaking of which of my various works will survive me, I already know it's going to be Serial Killer. That outsells everything. But you can apply that to authors as well. You never know which one will suddenly be Nathaniel Hawthorne instead of those 6 or 7 other people that sold better than him back in the day.
Well, and to bring this back to book publicity, they don't know, like, I talked a lot earlier about the new authors that might break out.
Mm-hmm.
That ignores the mid-list, which the mid-list is really important to our genre.
Yeah.
The mid-list is in some ways kind of a ground where new things are happening, but also where kind of old mainstays are happening. And it's serving the needs of our audience in ways that sometimes the bestsellers can't. And you never know when the mid-lister is George R. R. Martin, because he was when I was...
For decades.
Yeah, for decades. He won the Campbell Award, which has been renamed.
Yeah.
The Rookie of the Year Award mm-hmm. in science fiction fantasy, the first year that it was ever offered. And I know this because I was sitting morose one of the days. I think I've told this story before. I lost that award twice, once mm-hmm. to Naomi Novik, once to John Scalzi,
yeah.
who were both fantastic authors who very much deserved their awards. But I, you know, I was sitting morose one day, you know, one of those days at the after party, and George walked back and he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Don't worry, kid. I lost that damn award the first year they offered it." And I'm like, eh, I'm in good company with George there. And that was, you know, the 70s or the 60s maybe. And then he wrote a book in the mid 90s that became the biggest epic fantasy of our generation.
And he was basically a mid-list science fiction author most of that time
mm-hmm.
until he said, you know, I'm going to invent a whole new subgenre.
Yep.
One thing that I think this discussion has to come back to on some level is, you know, we talk about you never know what'll work. You never know mm-hmm. which app all your readers are paying attention to. You never know which book is going to just hit the culture in the weak spot. But there is one thing that does pretty much always work, which is money. Like, and that's not true in every case. I'm sure that if we thought about it, we could think of some books that were pushed super hard and completely flopped.
Yeah.
But for the most part, a publisher can pick one or two titles a year and just straight up guarantee that they will be bestsellers because that's where they put their money.
Yes and no. So if they are strategic about their choices, is the caveat I put on that. Money doesn't equal bestseller. Otherwise, like we would see this in video games more, right? Like Suicide Squad kills the Justice League is absolutely flopping. And they put so much money into that. It's the same thing in movies, the same thing in books. It can cause initial first week sales, but money plus good book can overcome that. When good book plus, like, you don't have to have book that's going to revolutionize the genre, because that is the best thing. If you can get money plus book that revolutionizes the genre, which is, you know, Game of Thrones, then suddenly, you know, it's huge. But if you can just get good book, and they are better at picking those than sometimes we pretend. But sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
It's better in books than it is in video games and in films. But you can see the stuff that they think is going to be huge and they sink all this money into. And
then it just like, never happens. I feel like I see that on Audible a lot where, you know, every time I go to the site, there's the same ad for the same book that I've already seen ads for on Reddit and other places. And I don't know anyone who's ever read it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, on the other hand, you've got, for example, which Harry Potter book did you discover? Because for me, it was three.
I think it was three for me.
I feel like that's one that went under the radar for a long time.
It did.
And it wasn't until we were three books into the series before everyone realized, oh, this isn't just the throw it at a wall. This stuck. We need to start, you know, paying attention to it.
Yeah, and so, I don't know, like, publicity, it is hard, particularly, like, it worked a certain way for a long time. This whole idea of it changes every 5 minutes didn't exist in the 70s through the 90s.
Yeah.
You could really consistently know what would work for publicity. Book tours were really important during that era because it introduces the author to the audience, to the booksellers. It gets them out there and people seeing their face. You didn't have social media. It made the author more personable. And book tours were really effective. Even if up front they didn't make money, they were super effective for long-term growth of a fan base. Book tours are no longer nearly as effective. They stopped being effective in the early 2010s. And I mean, publishing still thinks you should do them if you're a big author. I stopped doing them in 2020 with the pandemic and haven't gone back to them. And guess what? It hasn't mattered.
Yeah.
Because
it's a totally different thing. I basically stopped in 2014, I think, with Ruins. That was, well, that's not true. I tried to do a book tour again in 17 or in 16, I mean, when Makeover came out. But essentially, at some point in there, 15 or 16, replaced them completely with just going to conventions, and it worked so much better. But even when you and I broke in, which was the early aughts, I think early and I was late aughts, they still thought that it was stable.
Yeah, it worked. Like, my career was partially made by book tours because of that same legacy ideas still were functional then. Meet the booksellers. Most books still sold through booksellers. Amazon hadn't taken over as much as it would starting in 2009.
Well, and I mean just the concept of stability was still something they thought they could rely on.
Exactly.
And so when book blogs appeared, that was the decade when book blogs were huge, and publishers were just like, oh, here's this new tool that has emerged.
Yep.
And it didn't occur to them that that was going to disappear. And when I was trying to promote like my cyberpunk series and some of the stuff in the teens, book blogs were garbage. Book blogs actually died partway through the partial series because they sold the first book incredibly well. Second book, no one cared about book blogs anymore.
This is just kind of my, I have very little justification for this belief, but kind of my theory that part of the problem that's happening right now in the film industry is that the film industry has finally hit the sort of thing that books have been dealing with forever, which is there's so much media that it's really hard to cut through it and get anyone's attention. Mm-hmm. And that's always been that way for books because there's always been media, you know, maybe not in the 1800s, you know, in the modern and contemporary eras, it's always been that way for books. We're fighting for this small portion of attention. So publicity is a very strange thing.
And films are now dealing with that. They used to have, this is again my theory, I think I may have mentioned it on here, they used to have the perfect way to sell future films, which was people went to the theaters and saw the trailers, made them excited. They then looked forward to that film, and then they went and saw it. Mm-hmm. And now they stopped going to movies, the theaters, because of COVID. They stopped seeing the trailers. Now suddenly movies have to do what books have always had to do, which is find a way to get people to actually pay attention. And they're completely floundering because they've never had to do that before.
Yeah.
People don't watch the talk shows, so they don't see the stars. They don't go to the theaters, so they don't see the trailers. How do you convince people to go to films?
Mm-hmm. The 1-2 punch of on-demand streaming being ridiculously accessible and then COVID changing everyone's behaviors and habits. If anything kills the blockbuster era of movies, it's going to be those two things working together.
And see, I think you're right, but I don't think people are highlighting how it's a publicity problem as much as anything else. They're just saying, oh, people don't want to go to the theater anymore, which there is an experience
in
that.
And that's true. But when you go to a theater, there's like six movies playing.
Yeah.
When you open Amazon Prime Video, there's 6,000. And so, yeah, it's very hard unless you pay for that end cap, whatever the digital version of that is.
Doesn't work anymore. That's what they're finding. Otherwise, Indiana Jones would have been a...
No, that's true.
That's the problem. And I think you're wrong. Money plus thing doesn't work anymore. It hasn't worked in books for a long time. Otherwise, you know, we would have more out-of-nowhere bestsellers, and we don't. There are a lot of consistent... famous bestsellers. So I think the whole industry is going to have to learn. People don't want to watch ads anymore, which, you know what? I don't blame them. But they don't watch ads. They don't get marketed to. Mm-hmm. And now movies are going to have to figure out how to market to those people.
Figure out what to do. I have to admit that a lot of my opinions on, well, they can just pay and then things will work, comes from my experience with the book Dumplin'. Because I and several other friends were trying to sell YA at the time that came out.
Yeah.
And we were all bitter about it because they poured all their money behind Dumplin'. And then I finally read Dumplin' and it's genuinely a great book.
Mm.
Like, it deserved the attention that it got. And so that upfront bitterness of, why are they giving money to this thing I've never heard of instead of me? They made the right decision.
How's that, Ben?